Welcome to The B Word, a podcast about humans, organizations, behavior. I'm your host, James Healy. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Growing up in the north of England in the 1980s, mental health wasn't a term you ever heard or a topic that people talked about. Occasionally, you might hear about someone having something mysteriously called a nervous breakdown, but such people were spoken of in hushed tones, and it was never really clear what exactly such a breakdown would involve. There was always an implication of shame or embarrassment. Fast forward to the 2020s, and things are very different. There's much more openness around mental health, and much of the stigma that used to be associated with the topic has thankfully reduced, in many societies at least. It's probably not a coincidence that those same societies are, as is widely reported, experiencing an unprecedented epidemic of mental health problems, particularly among the young. Social media, itself often conjectured to be a cause of much mental ill health, is ironically awash with mental health content. Organizations are pouring billions into corporate well-being initiatives. Often, the more eye-catching, the better. And mental health is a huge focus for the pharmaceutical industry. The most popular type of antidepressants, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, marketed under brand names like Prozac and Zoloft, are a huge business, worth $17 billion globally in 2022 and taken by around 14% of adults in Western countries. At the same time, research into novel therapies like the gut microbiome, and even psychedelic drugs, has made headlines across the globe. Mental health is suddenly, and thankfully, a big deal. But amid all the hype, where's the science? How well do we really understand mental health? How well do we understand the treatments? Today's guest has some of the answers. Camilla Nord leads the Mental Health Neuroscience Program of Research at the MRC Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit, University of Cambridge. Camilla works to answer questions like, what changes in our brain during periods of mental ill health? How does the way our brains process the world make us susceptible to developing a mental health disorder? And how can we capitalize on the tools of neuroscience, brain imaging, brain stimulation, computational modeling, among others, to improve our ability to diagnose and treat mental health disorders? Camilla is the author of a recent book, The Balanced Brain, The Science of Mental Health. Camilla, good morning. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning, James. It's lovely to be here.
So I'm going to start with a question about what exactly you do. I'd like you to clarify for the listeners, what exactly is the difference between a neuroscientist who focuses on mental health, a psychologist, and a psychiatrist?
Well, these are all jobs I considered having at one point in my life, but I decided to have this particular job, which is that I'm a researcher. I run a lab, and in my lab, we run experiments to try to understand the causes of mental health conditions and also to try to discover new ways of treating mental health conditions. And this is quite different than my, I guess, alternative career paths where I might have become a psychologist, where you're treating typically patients with therapeutic techniques, things like cognitive behavioral therapy, or a psychiatrist where you are a medical doctor and you might be doing psychological therapy, you might be prescribing drugs, you might be incorporating other aspects of someone's physical health into your treatment. And so those are all really great ways to understand mental health. But the way that I've taken is an experimental one. So I run research studies where I come up with an idea, and then my lab and I, we work out how we're going to implement it, how we're going to test it. It might be, is this region in the brain involved in these kinds of symptoms? So then we use a brain scanner to ask the question. It might be, is this brain neurotransmitter involved in it? So then we might use a drug to explore the question, and so on and so forth.
Awesome. Thank you. I think that's a helpful clarification. I know lots of people get those three areas slightly confused. Now, we're going to talk a lot today about your recent book, which I loved and highly recommend to anyone who's listening, by the way. You titled the book, The Balanced Brain, The Science of Mental Health. So there's a couple of questions that are prompted by that title, at least for me. Firstly, what do you mean by mental health?
Maybe the hardest question of all. So mental health, I chose to use that term of the very many ways that we can use to describe well-being, psychiatric health, any of the other sort of ways that different subgroups might define it, because I think it encompasses both the things that we all feel, the ebbs and flows in our own mental states, and also when those ebbs and flows tip over into mental ill health, into clinical disorders. And my book really touches on both. So it's not specifically a book about mental illness, but it does talk about mental illness, the roots to mental illness. And it's not just a book about well-being, although it does talk about our own kind of perceptions of our happiness and well-being and the building blocks in our brain that construct this.
Thank you. We will come back to some of those topics later, I think. The second question on the title is about the second, well, it's about the first part of the title, actually. Why the balanced brain? What's so important and relevant about balance in this context?
Well, the idea that I argue in my book is that mental health is a little bit like homeostasis in the body. So in the same way that our body needs to pursue things to maintain that kind of homeostasis, a dynamic process where we drink when we're thirsty and we eat when we're hungry and so on, so too does our brain need to attempt some kind of homeostasis. It seeks some kind of homeostasis. And this is really via very many different processes, but one very important one is learning about the world, learning what has happened in the past to better predict what will happen next. This is a very influential framework in neuroscience called predictive coding, which is sort of one umbrella term that encompasses some of my theories about mental health in the book. But it's really an argument that what mental health is a return to this balance, to this homeostasis after perturbation. So we all face stresses, challenges, things that could take away our mental health on a daily basis, some more than others, unfortunately. But our brains have this capacity to return to a broader view of the world in the context of mental health, a view that bad things might happen, but overall, the world is not so bad.
Thank you. I want to pick up there on the topic of prediction, because I think you touched on it briefly. I think for people who aren't familiar with the neuroscience literature, the whole idea of predictive coding is, I think, very surprising, and people will find that interesting. Also, I'm a sucker for interesting and somewhat quirky studies, and I know that you often explain this with reference to monkeys and fruit juice, which I think is a perfect explanation.
Yes, a little bit of a quirky study. This was really an experiment that kind of changed the face of neuroscience. It was done in the late 1990s, where scientists were recording from neurons deep inside monkeys' brains. And these neurons that they were recording from were dopaminergic. So they were dopamine responsive neurons. And what the scientists found that these dopaminergic neurons did was that when monkeys received an unexpected reward, which was in their case a drop of juice in their mouth, these neurons fired. So it was a surprise, a good surprise, what they called a reward prediction error. But over time, the monkeys saw a flash of light, then got a juice, a flash of light, then got a little juice. And so the juice became predictable, it became expected. And then the neurons were no longer interested in the juice after a while. They became interested in the cue, predicting the juice. So they became sort of like anticipation neurons. And then later on, if the scientists didn't give juice after a flash of light, say the monkeys got water instead, which is fine, but not as good as juice, then these dopamine neurons actually suppressed their firing below baseline. So that's also a surprise, a negative surprise, or negative reward prediction error. So in essence, what these brain cells were doing was learning. So a learning signature in the brain, learning to predict what would happen next and incorporating that into the signals that the cells were sending.
I think most people listening to this will probably have heard of dopamine. It's, I think, a very well-known but probably quite misunderstood neurotransmitter. I think most people have probably heard or thought a little bit about learning and learning reinforcement. I think what's really interesting is the implications of this predictive coding idea for so many aspects of human behavior. And you touch on there what in other contexts might be called loss aversion, or I guess that sort of relative change in the way that we perceive something based on expectations. Specifically around mental health, do you want to talk a little bit about what this implies for mental health?
So there are a few different interpretations of this for mental health, and it depends on the type of mental health we're talking about. So the process I've described, one very obvious way that it plays into mental health is in the context of drug addiction. Many addictive drugs are inherently dopaminergic, so they're affecting this learning system, and they are modifying the things that you learn about and the things that your brain predicts. So you can see these dopamine responses in humans who are addicted to certain substances just from looking at pictures of those substances. So that is the kind of anticipatory dopamine response. Really, really interesting. But I think some of that work, whilst incredibly important, has actually led to the very misunderstandings about dopamine that you're referring to. So just because dopamine is involved in learning about drugs doesn't mean that there's something inherently bad about dopamine. It means that dopamine is involved in learning about the world, learning about the things that are important to us as individuals. So it shouldn't be taken as a reason that we should want to reduce our dopamine or go on a dopamine fast, which would actually be a really, really bad idea. There are some people who don't have enough dopamine, for example, in the context of Parkinson's disease. And that comes with debilitating symptoms, both in terms of movement, but also apathy, feeling like you're not motivated to do anything. So a lack of dopamine is not something to aspire to. And then there are many other ways that this has been contextualized in mental health, but I'll tell you sort of one other, and that is in the context of motivation. So whilst you can see disruptions, blunted motivation in Parkinson's disease, you also see it in many patients with depression. This kind of lack of energy, lack of a desire to pursue the things that we previously found rewarding is characteristic of many depressive episodes and is often a symptom that doesn't respond very well to even our best treatments, even the treatments that might do well for other kinds of symptoms like low mood. It doesn't treat these motivational symptoms so well. So that kind of gives you the idea that there may be dopaminergic systems underpinning some of the symptoms in depression, which does seem to be the case.
So we've talked a little bit about dopamine, and as we're talking about depression, I want to talk about another neurotransmitter here. And again, I think this is something that is fairly well known in the literature, but has perhaps not made it out into the wider world yet. And this is around serotonin, and particularly some of the very common, very popular antidepressants. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and about, I guess, the latest thinking on how SSRIs work and how they perhaps don't work?
Yeah, so SSRIs, I wouldn't have predicted this, you know, early on in my career, but they've become a very, very controversial topic. And I think part of the reason for that is, you know, our fault being the sort of scientific and medical communities. Because in the 1990s, to tell you sort of the story about serotonergic drugs for depression, it became kind of accepted fact that depression was caused by some kind of deficit in serotonin. And that's why antidepressants worked, because they increased serotonin. But this actually wasn't the way around things were discovered. It's just that antidepressant drugs, as they were originally discovered, increased levels of serotonin and, at the time, other neurotransmitters. And then that seemed to actually help symptoms of depression in many people. So then there was like some reverse inference in thinking, well, maybe there was something wrong with these neurotransmitters in the first place. And I don't really take a super hard line on this, but I think it's pretty clear that certainly not every patient with depression has some kind of global deficit in serotonin. There may well be sort of subtle changes in the serotonin system in some contexts, in some areas, but it's not as clear as what people initially thought. And this was already true by kind of the early 2000s. We knew this. But unfortunately, it really didn't get disseminated back to the public. It's much easier to disseminate a kind of positive thing. This is what causes depression, than a kind of negative thing like, oh, it's more complicated. Oh, what a boring, like nobody wants to say that. It's really not a, you know, not a fun communication strategy. So as a result, there is today a lot of controversy about serotonergic drugs to treat depression like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, in part because it's sort of like a gotcha from people who think that they don't work. They're saying, well, actually, depression doesn't even show a deficit in serotonin. And actually, that's sort of not even an argument that is ongoing in science. It's like a dead argument, really. So that's really the origins, or one of the origins, of why there's so much controversy in selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor SSRI treatment. There are other reasons to do with kind of side effects that we can get into. But what I want to tell you about today is what I actually think antidepressants are doing, which is, so the kind of mystery of antidepressants is that if you give someone a single dose, it increases their levels of serotonin, but it doesn't change their mood. People have to take it for weeks until it changes their mood. And now, a number of years ago, a very prominent theory came about, which speculated that perhaps antidepressant drugs were changing something immediately, just not mood. And what researchers Catherine Harmer and Phil Cowan at Oxford found was that if you give people a single dose of an SSRI, it changes their emotion processing. So they become less biased towards negative information in the world, whether that be faces or sentences, and more likely to interpret those in a neutral way. So you can think about this in your day-to-day life. If you're walking down the corridor at work and your colleague blanks you, when you say hello, maybe that colleague is having a bad day, a bit busy, didn't notice you, lost in thought. Maybe your colleague secretly hates you. And those are two valid interpretations of that neutral outcome. And so I think what antidepressant drugs do is make you a little bit more likely to choose the first explanation than the second. This is what's called a cognitive theory of antidepressant action, meaning it's changing something about your cognition, something about the way you process the world, and then eventually that has knock-on effects on your mood. So I think this is a very powerful theory for why they work. It may also be, incidentally, a powerful theory for why they don't work, because we do know that in a number of patients, maybe 40, some data even 50%, they don't have a sufficient effect on depression in those people. And it could be, one interpretation is that those people, the source of their depression is maybe not in those negative biases, or maybe the antidepressant itself isn't changing that person's negative biases. So there may be a kind of a subgroup of people with depression for whom changing these processes is very core, very useful for improving their mood, and then other people for whom it's not. And we could use that information in future.
So I think it's key in that discussion, and I think you made this clear, but I want to say explicitly, antidepressants, particularly the type of antidepressants that we're talking about, do work. They do work for a, you know, relatively large proportion of people, and they work better than a placebo. One of the interesting things in the book is this topic of placebos, which is something that I think I hadn't really given much thought to, and I think a lot about these kinds of things. Do you want to talk a bit about the fact that placebos are often quite effective, and it's a sort of underrepresented, understated phenomenon?
Yeah, placebos do get kind of a bad rap, but I think they are both phenomenally important medically, but also tell us something actually quite crucial about the brain anyway, which kind of takes us back to the predictive coding idea. So on the medical side, we know that even very effective interventions like, say, opioids for analgesia to reduce pain, they don't work as well when someone doesn't know they're getting them. So you can do experiments where someone is getting an infusion of opioid drugs, and then at some point they're told now the drug has started. And that's actually when much of the painkilling effect kicks in. So they still get some painkilling effect from the drug itself, but the kind of full clinical response requires the placebo effect. So at least in the case of some treatments for conditions like pain, and I would argue mental health, actually the placebo effect is part of the true, of the full clinical efficacy as you would experience it as a patient. Of course, as a scientist, the placebo effect is really annoying because you want to kind of actually find it's very important that you find a treatment that is better than the placebo effect. Otherwise, why would it be worth side effects? Why would it be worth prescription and so on? So it's very important scientifically to have something better than placebo. But from a kind of patient point of view, actually the placebo effect is great. And it also explains why things that kind of like aren't true scientifically, like why things like homeopathy or other sorts of alternative medical treatments can have really powerful effects in some people. And that's because the placebo effect itself is so powerful. It's not experienced as a placebo effect. It's experienced as genuine. When you recover from a treatment, actually, you don't really have conscious access to whether that recovery was via placebo or via some other mechanism. You're just better, and that's great. And then the other thing about placebos that I love is what it tells you about the brain. So what it tells you is that in our brain, we have physical systems that represent the placebo effect. These are systems involved in our expectations and beliefs about the world. So the placebo effect isn't nothing. It is something. It is a change in areas in our brain and properties of the cells firing. And these areas then communicate, in fact, with the body. So there are experiments showing that the placebo effect involves communication from the brain through the spinal cord in order to reduce pain. So these are physical processes that are essentially manifested by our expectations.
So I'm glad you went there because that was the topic I wanted to bring up next. I think we live in a world that has been conditioned over hundreds of years to, I guess, almost over-mentalize. We've taken Cartesian dualism, and people who've never heard of René Descartes, who have no idea what Cartesian dualism is, have internalized this idea that the mind and the body are separate and different. One of the most interesting things in your book, and one of the things that hopefully people take away from this conversation, is that that dualism, that distinction between mind and body, is a myth. And when we think about mental health, we've got to think more holistically.
Yeah, 100%. In fact, I would say that was my main motivation to write this book. It was because I felt that in discussions about mental health, wherever I turned, there was this presumption of dualism. Even the whole argument about whether an experience like depression should be treated pharmacologically or with psychological therapy involves this dissociation between biological mechanisms and sort of psychological mechanisms or trauma that someone's been through. There is no dissociation. All your experiences are instantiated physically, and something only affects you, whether that's a trauma or childhood experiences or your genes, in that it changes the biology of your brain and wider nervous system. And psychological therapy changes the brain as well as drugs. So I really felt it was quite important to get across the argument that there is no separability between psychological and biological. There is no real differentiation between, in my view, between the mental and the brain.
And I think one of the ways that you explain this, and I think one of the ways that people can really understand this, is this link between physical sensations and emotions. Because we're conditioned to think that emotions are mental phenomena. You talk about being hangry. How does that help explain this key message?
So I used the kind of fun example of hangry, because I think it illustrates how we all interpret our bodily signals to understand what we're feeling at any given moment. It's not that I don't think mental states exist. It's just that I think they're generated by biological phenomena. Like, how else would they be generated? And one of the ways in which our emotions are generated or at least influenced are the signals happening throughout our body. So that means that similar signals can sometimes be misinterpreted, reinterpreted as different things in the context of hangry. Signals of discomfort and other kind of signs that you have low blood sugar can be misread as feeling irritable, feeling angry. So I think it kind of is a neat example of how intertwined our physical states are with our emotional states. But of course, the opposite direction is also true. So things that have really affected you emotionally or are very much affecting you in your stress levels, those have physical repercussions. Lots of people have, stomach aches when they're stressed. In fact, it's the most common manifestation of childhood anxiety as just stomach aches. So there's, you know, a bi-directional link there.
You mentioned stomach aches. One of the things you touch on in the book is some of the new research that gets a lot of press around the link between the biome, the gut, and the brain. And I think it's fascinating that this topic has got so much traction in the media. It almost appears like the first time people have thought that there might be this mind-body link after all. What's the truth of the current state around this research? Should people listening to this be getting excited? Should they be thinking that probiotic yogurts and various other things are going to improve their mental health?
You know, I really thought when I was writing my book that I would have to go back and rewrite this section, but it hasn't happened yet. So when I was writing the book, I felt that the current state of the literature was a little bit weak when it came to direct evidence that the microbiome in humans influences mental health. And this is in spite of what I would say are really, really exciting findings from animal research showing that in rodents, the microbiome does seem to affect what you might call, you know, anxiety and depression-like behavior in rodents. But the problem is that there is actually quite a big leap between rodents and humans, and not just in the obvious way. Some of it is just what you can control experimentally. So humans have this incredibly noisy bacterial environment. You can't like keep them in germ-free cages and breed them. And so, you know, that's not how human experiments work. So far, the effects that we see in humans are not as clear, not as reliable. But I am still really interested in this because there is undoubtedly a biological link between the microbiome and the rest of the body. So it affects, for example, inflammatory processes. It seems to maybe communicate with the brain via the vagus nerve. So there is a kind of potential mechanism. Whether or not you should go out and buy probiotics on is, are the effects big enough to be important for most people, one, and two, are the effects on mental health, if they exist, direct, i.e. you're eating probiotics and that's changing your mental health, or do they actually go via some kind of middle pathway? So a total speculation I have in the book, I'd love to test this in an experiment, is that, as I said, many people with mental health problems also experience gut problems. And so the microbiome definitely affects your gut health, no debate there. And it's possible that by improving your gut health, decreasing gastric symptoms, IBS, and so on, if that's happening, then so too might your mental health be improved. So that's an indirect explanation. So that's kind of my take on the microbiome literature. You can see sort of in big population studies associations between diversity of microbiome or particular microbiome bacteria and mental health, but that could occur because of lots of other reasons. So different diets, socioeconomic reasons. So there's not that's not totally convincing to me yet. But I do think there are obvious studies to be done that will be done. A lot of interest is in this area. Funding is in this area. So I am hopeful that we will have a better sense of whether, and if so, when the microbiome is important for mental health in the next maybe 5 years.
So watch this space. While we're on this topic of experimental treatments that are getting a lot of media coverage, I'm personally fascinated by the idea that we've moved so quickly from a war on drugs to a world where psychedelics are now seen as the next big thing for mental health, particularly because I was reliably informed when I was growing up that if I looked at a psychedelic, I would probably develop schizophrenia or worse. Where's this research at? Should people be rushing out there and dropping psychedelics to make themselves feel better?
Yeah, psychedelics is such an interesting topic, and it has a little bit of the microbiome in that the interest is so great, and then the data is kind of just catching up in some ways. And that was part of the reason that I wanted to write about all of these various treatments, because I guess I consider myself a scientist who is very, very happy and willing to publish a null result. I sort of like don't have a horse in the race. I just want a horse to win the race. Like I would like to, discover better treatments for mental health conditions, but I don't really care what kind of treatment that is. So I don't think it has to be psychedelics. It has to be the microbiome. It has to be antidepressants. I'm very willing to have, multiple runners. So my view on psychedelics is that for a long time, research into that area was suppressed, which was clearly a very negative thing for science. So there is, much to be learned about this entire class of drugs that hasn't been learned because of decades of, extremely strict government regulation. I now think there's been a kind of bounce that maybe has exceeded or at least precipitated the current potential of these drugs. And I think that for a couple reasons. So the first is that while psychedelic drugs do seem to have really large effect sizes on things like depression, so they really seem to improve depression, they seem to be a very effective treatment, they are very, very difficult to blind in a study. So that means that there is always a huge influence of the placebo effect. Again, for a patient, maybe not so important, but for a scientist, for a clinician deciding which treatment to give someone, actually quite important. And it's particularly important because some people do not have good experiences on psychedelic drugs. They do come with side effects or the potential for adverse experiences. And so, I think it's very important that we treat them like any other medication, not as some magical new class of something that isn't like other antidepressants. No, they're just a new example of a possible antidepressant, although also with potential for other conditions that we need to kind of rigorously assess, just like we would other drugs. And I know that there are studies to that effect going on. I think one of the challenges is that there's now a lot of business interest in it. And that sometimes means that people begin to suppress possible negative findings. So I think, we need to just sort of address psychedelic drugs. I think they have potential. I think we need to know exactly when they have potential, who they have potential for. That's what I would be focusing on going forwards.
So the formal recommendation from this podcast is not that everyone rushes out and buys mushrooms or acid, just to be clear.
No. But, maybe for some people for whom nothing else has worked, this could be a really important avenue. So I also think that the kind of total naysayers are probably wrong as well.
To be a little less flippant for a moment, what is the thinking around the mechanism by which psychedelics might work?
The mechanism by which psychedelics might work, it's really, really fascinating. So it depends on what level you mean mechanism, but I'm going to speak to the same sort of level as I spoke about antidepressant drugs. So I suspect psychedelic drugs work in a pretty different way than antidepressant drugs. And there are some very obvious reasons to suspect this. One, they don't target exactly the same type of serotonin receptors, although they're also serotonergic. But another one is that they work at a very different time scale So a single dose of psychedelics obviously has effects, but it also can have effects even on things like mood, which we know antidepressant drugs tend not to. So that means to me that there must be a kind of slightly different route, cognitive route, by which they're working. And one theory that I quite like is that psychedelic drugs are working on a sort of more top-down process than antidepressant drugs. If antidepressant drugs are changing something about your perception, your information processing, lots of little events in the world every day being perceived slightly differently, psychedelics are changing something at the level of your beliefs or expectations. And that might ring a bell because it sounds a little like placebo. And I think that is potentially true, but I haven't seen this theory formally published. So this is just something that I would suggest about psychedelics, which is that if they're working at this higher level, this level of beliefs about the world, that is not totally different than the level at which a placebo works. It's not totally different than the level at which some psychological therapies that work on kind of maladaptive beliefs about the world and weakening those beliefs work either. It's just potentially weakening those beliefs very acutely in an immediate fashion. And then in concert with psychological therapy, it can have longer term effects on mood. I do the particular work that I think is most powerful in psychedelic work is the combination of psychedelics and psychological therapy. So you'll notice in almost every psychedelic study, there is some kind of psychological therapy. They don't make a big deal of it. But I actually think that is a really integral part of it being an effective treatment for mental health conditions, especially for kind of longevity, for it to work long after the effect.
So it's not psychedelics, but I'm glad we've got to this point in the conversation. Do you want to talk a little bit about those more traditional psychological therapies and how they work? And I guess what might explain some of the variance in how well they work?
I became very interested in psychological therapy during my PhD. So I became interested in what changes in the brain when someone has cognitive behavioral therapy, one of the most common forms of psychological therapy, about as effective as antidepressant drugs for depression. And I wondered if those areas were actually quite different than what is changed by antidepressants. And in this case, unlike psychedelics, I actually tested it. So I looked at what changes in the brain after a course of psychological therapy or from before to after, compared to what changes from before to after antidepressant drugs. And I found these two distinct regions in the brain that were an overlapping effect of all different kinds of psychological therapy. They all changed this region called the medial prefrontal cortex, which is involved in sort of our awareness of our own emotional state, kind of slightly higher level region, you might say. Whereas antidepressant drugs quite robustly changed activity in the amygdala. So that is a region involved in actually lots of different things, but one of them is emotion processing and the process I've described. So these are two regions, both sort of vaguely involved in emotion, involved in mood, but with different roles in those functions. So that's sort of the way that I view psychological therapy. Changes the brain, it changes aspects of the brain. I think those aspects are a little bit distinct from antidepressant drugs. Where I think psychological therapy could go in the future, something I find really exciting, is what I've called in my research acute augmentations of psychological therapy. These are things that you give once you understand what is changing about the brain in psychological therapy, you can then improve it with sometimes a biological treatment, or sometimes by, you know, if it's something like a process that you know is changed by someone's circadian rhythm, you could time psychological therapy with the time of the day. If you know it involves learning, you could use a medication that changes learning just at the time of the session. So it's a different model than like separately considering drugs and separately considering therapy, or separately considering lifestyle factors like sleep or exercise and separately considering therapy. It's actually thinking about a deliberate sort of science-driven way of combining psychological therapy with augmentations based on the biology that we know about therapy.
So that combination of treatments, that combination of approaches, I mean, that's very standard at the moment. You wouldn't usually get just antidepressants or just, you know, CBT. But there is this kind of constant demand in this space for a silver bullet. One of the really fascinating things that you talk about, and I think one of the most important things, is this idea that there aren't silver bullets. What works for one person may not work for another. And I think that's probably a good place for us to finish. So do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, it might sound depressing that there isn't a silver bullet, but I think every week we hear about a different silver bullet. And lots of people get their expectations up. They think, this is the thing that will work for me. And when you're a scientist who really has a single horse in the race, then, you know, you've got to communicate it as a silver bullet, because maybe it could help some people who haven't been helped before. But I do not think that in the case of mental health, there will be a silver bullet. Not psychedelics, not getting rid of mobile phones, as we've recently argued, in any kind of capacity. I do not think there is a single source of our mental distress at the moment, of mental ill health. Instead, I think to really revolutionize the treatment of mental health, we need to use our current treatment arsenal and innovate new treatments in a different way, in a bespoke way, maybe taking inspiration from fields like cancer medicine, which has become very, very personalized. You don't get treatment for breast cancer. Nowadays, you often get treatment for the individual kind of genetic cause of your breast cancer. So similarly, although I think probably not just reliant on genes, we need to do something similar in mental health. Take a better measure of what we think that treatment will change, what we know needs to be changed in that patient, and innovate treatment pathways to do that instead of trying to map everyone on to one class of treatments.
Thank you, Camilla. Thank you for the conversation. Thank you for the work that you're doing in this space. It's so important and can have such a profound effect on so many people.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
Cogito ergo sum, or in English, I think, therefore I am. René Descartes wrote what are arguably the most famous words in the history of Western philosophy almost 400 years ago. Descartes' insight enshrined something that seems like common sense to most of us, the idea that we have a mind separate from our bodies. It's certainly how most of us live our lives, whether or not we realize it. We tend to assume there's a fundamental distinction between our brains and our bodies, between the mental and the physical. It's right there in the title of this episode. The topic Camilla and I discussed was mental health. And yet, when you stop to think about it, unless you're willing to believe in some fairly spooky concepts, it's impossible to claim that mental experience arises from anything other than our brains. If you've ever encountered anyone who suffered a brain injury, like a stroke, or a degenerative brain condition like dementia, you'll be familiar with the radical changes in personality and behavior that can often result. There's no doubt in those cases that physical changes in the brain lead to profound mental changes. But it's not just these extreme cases. All mental phenomena, all of our mental experiences, including mental health, ultimately have physical causes. Our brains and our minds aren't separate. Our brains and our bodies aren't separate, any more than our livers or hearts or lungs are separate from the rest of our bodies. As Camilla and I discussed, there's some really exciting research into the link between the gut microbiome, the bacteria in our intestines, and mental health. It shouldn't be so surprising that one part of our body might influence another. I suspect that in time, we'll come to understand there are all manner of complex interactions between our brains and the rest of our bodies. In time, we'll realize that physical health and mental health are intimately intertwined. But what that statement, "I suspect that in time we'll come to understand," indicates is just how young neuroscience is and how little we still know about our brains. And that's illustrated by the fairly astonishing, but widely known fact that there is no real explanation for how the most popular type of antidepressants work. No one credible disputes that they do work, for many people. But at this point, no one can really explain how or why. And I'm similarly fascinated by Camilla's work on placebos. It's incredible to me that what we believe really, really seems to influence what we experience and what physically happens in our bodies. This idea that much of our experience is the result of the brain's predictions is absolutely mind-blowing, and it's something we'll come back to in subsequent episodes. When you add it all together, it's clear that brains are complicated. As I said in our previous episode with Joe Devlin, they're the most complex object in the known universe. We've come a long way from nervous breakdowns, but we have a very long way still to go until we can truly claim to understand our brains and our mental health. You've been listening to The B Word, a podcast produced by Izzy Rakic and Armani Williams, and hosted by me, James Healy. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.